So I think Santa Barbara has most perfect climate for theoreticians, and I really enjoy being here. And so I'll talk about critical behavior in multiferroic materials, and two previous talks already underscored the importance of fluctuations in this material, so I will also tell something about that. So I'd like to acknowledge people, mostly experimentalists, but also Daniel Chomsky and my student Andreas Kramucci. So I'll talk about anomalies of dielectric constant in 1-5 and 1-3 materials, talk a little bit about magnets and electromagnets in the spiral materials, then multiferroic behavior in thin films, what Yoshi Takura told, electric control of domains. And if time permits, which I'm sure it will not, I'll talk about magnetocapacitance in scaling in hexagonal manganites. So there is a simple argument why in materials where polarization is induced magnetically, a magnetic fluctuation should play an important role in dielectric properties. So I just wrote down the free energy where I couple polarization to some combination of magnetic order parameters, which depending on material can have a different form. And then I just add terms which are responsible for dielectric response in non-magnetic state. And then minimizing with respect to polarization, you immediately see that polarization is the polarization induced by electric field plus the spontaneous polarization, which is proportional to this combination of magnetic order parameters. So if it's average non-zero, then polarization is non-zero. But then fluctuation dissipation theorem tells you that the dielectric constant of the whole sample is proportional to the average of the fluctuation of polarization squared, yeah, of the sample. So the dielectric constant can be expressed through the connected correlation function of magnetic operators. And because, so the integral of this connected correlation function, and because close to TC correlation length diverge, this quantity, this integral, can very easily diverge as well, so that would result to divergence of dielectric constant. Mm. So one example, so first example is this 1-5 material. It's a little bit of controversy still whether what, you know, is the driving mechanism for polarization this material. So Paolo actually presented some arguments in favor of magnetostriction. I also think it's probably likely the magnetostrictive mechanism. And this is my simple version of of this mechanism. So if you look in the B direction, you have alternation of manganese 3 plus, manganese 3 plus, manganese 4 plus. So I just plotted here a chain in the B direction, 3 plus, 3 plus, 4 plus. If you look also, so charge modulation with period 3. If you look also at spins, they also alternate down, down, up, down, down, up. So also, you know, modulation of spins with period 3. Now, manganese 4 plus here finds between the spin with, you know, between the manganese 3 plus with parallel spin and antiparallel spin. And just, you know, usual magnetostriction shifted towards in the direction in which the exchange coupling increases. And because the periods are the same, they all increase in the same direction. So this gives the polarization in the B direction. So phenomenologically, you call, you know, this parameter where, you know, the manganese 3 plus with parallel spins is to the left, you call it L1. And when it is, you know, from the right, you call it L2. And the polarization in two cases, you know, has opposite direction. So the coupling would be just P L1 squared minus L2 squared. Now, from this simple consideration, you would expect that, you know, transition to ferroelectric state would not result in the divergence of dielectric constant, because all what happens is that, you know, that the center of energy, you know, potential energy for this manganese 4 plus ion kind of shifts to the right, but the frequency of oscillation, you know, should remain the same, so there shouldn't be any divergence. But if you take into account fluctuation, which I did here, you see that dielectric constant is proportional to the correlation function of the square of the order parameter, which is more or less the same as the leading divergence in the magnetic contribution to specific heat. And if you just without thinking much take this holmium agonist O5 and plot the epsilon divergency at the ferroelectric transition, that would be this one, and the dielectric and the specific heat divergence, you see that they look very much alike. Although, of course, if you really want to see the critical indices, you have to do a better job here. Now, another example is this 113 material, and as was already said in the previous talks, this material becomes a spiral due to the competing interactions between the manganese ions. You've seen already this diagram. So first it becomes sinusoidal, and then it becomes spiral, and it is in this spiral state that this materials, terbium and dysprosium manganite, are ferroelectric. Yeah? So, and the nice property of these materials is that by applying magnetic field, you can flop the polarization, the spiral plane, and thereby you flop the polarization. And when you flop, you see this huge divergence of dielectric constant, so called giant magnetocapacitance effect. Now, in this case, the form of the magnetoelectric coupling looks somewhat different. Actually, here polarization is coupled to the magnetic order parameter times the gradient of magnetic order parameter. So the two, the second order of second power of magnetic order parameter takes care that this coupling is symmetric with respect to the time reversal, and polarization and gradient take care that it is also symmetric with respect to the inversion symmetry, and actually all other symmetries as well. So in this case, the inhomogeneous magnetic ordering gives rise to polarization, and but not any actually. If you take the sinusoidal ordering, collinear ordering, then you can calculate that polarization is zero, and that is very easy to see because any point on this line that passes through the maxima of magnetization actually is still in a center of inversion symmetry. But if you take a cycloidal spiral where spins rotate around, say, this axis E3, and the spiral propagates around the wave vector Q, then the polarization is proportional to the vector product of the spin rotation axis and the wave vector Q. Well, the mechanism here is just, as was already explained, just the Leshinsky-Marie interaction. And maybe I'll just I don't dwell on it too much. No. So what is common for essentially all these materials is that there is a high temperature phase where spins are collinear, and there is low temperature phase where spins form a cycloid, and which is actually ferroelectric. And this, of course, is just a consequence of magnetic anisotropy. So if you write down the simplest Ginzburg-Landau form of the free energy, you find out that the first transition occurs in the easy spin direction. So spin order along the easy direction, and then they form this collinear spiral. Whereas if you lower temperature further, then spins prefer to rotate rather than oscillate, because then the amplitude of the magnitude of spin remains more or less constant, and that stabilizes the spiral state, which is ferroelectric. And because of this kind of double transition nature, this improper ferroelectric has the same anomaly as the proper ferroelectric. We know this one-half law for ferroelectric, so the dielectric constant of normal ferroelectric is, say, 1 over T minus T critical, and 1/2 of T critical minus T. So here it works like this. The point is that the polarization is proportional to the product of amplitude along, say, of the sinusoidal part and the sinusoidal part. But the sinusoidal part already exists at higher temperature, yeah? So that couples linearly polarization to the, you know, to sinusoidal part that appears only below the second transition. And so that's why the other parameter, you know, grows like a square root. But because of this linear coupling, essentially the anomalies of the dielectric constant are the same as for proper ferroelectrics. Of course, if you go beyond the Gaussian fluctuation, you have to put here the correct indices. Now, now in this proper ferroelectric, you know that there is this story about if this ferroelectric is displaced, there is a story about the softening of phonon at the ferroelectric transition. So what would be the analog of this softening in this spiral magnet? Yeah? This actually closely ties to the to what already Naota mentioned about the optical optical absorption in this spiral magnets. So there are two ways in these materials to excite magnets. So one possibility is just the usual one. So the photon due to the Zeeman interaction excite magnet. And another one is that the photon, say, is absorbed by some polar phonon, and then due to this cubic coupling to magnetization, it excites magnet. So there is already a static magnet in the form of the spin density wave that gives wave vector q. Photon gives frequency omega, and out comes the magnet with frequency omega q. And of course, there is a possibility to excite the continuum of two magnets. So, and what I want to say is that these two processes can be quite comparable in strength because, you know, in this case, there is this weak magnetoelectric coupling, but in this case, there is a factor of alpha because it's magnetic interaction. Now, so so there is this question of electromagnets, and what I did, I just calculated the spectra of magnet for this spiral magnets, but not only in the spiral state, but also in the collinear state. So Naota and company did it for the perfectly circular case, in which case actually it is quite easy because you can go into rotating frame and then calculation of magnets is more or less the same like calculation of magnets in ferro or antifera magnet. But if you want really to calculate for elliptic spiral, magnets for elliptic spiral, so you have to do it somewhat differently. And so there is this complicated model. I will not go through all the details. The important thing is that it takes into account, you know, all this transition between the collinear and spiral phases. It takes into account magnetoelectric coupling. It takes into account the coupling between the antiferromagnetic coupling between the layers. And then you solve the coupled equation for phonons and for spins. And the problem here is that actually any of such excitation can have many harmonics. So both the ground state configuration can have many harmonics. But in any case, the excitation magnets, they can you know, have many many harmonics in this wave vector Q. Of the spiral. Okay, so this is an example of collinear state where you have, you know, cosinusoidal part, but no sinusoidal part, and this is, you know, the elliptic spiral where there is a cosinusoidal but also sinusoidal part, but sinusoidal is smaller than the cosinusoidal one. So for collinear state, this is the spectrum of the low energy part of the spectrum of magnet. It's actually quite rich. But what I want to say is that there is this one lowest lowest energy mode, which is blue here. Yeah, and in this mode, what happens is that the static part, so this is a collinear state, the static part is along B, but the oscillating part is in along C. So this is... so it's shown here with red, yeah, so it oscillates with time. So if at any moment you just, you know, freeze this oscillating part and add them, you will get a spiral which would have polarization in the C direction. So it's clear that this excitation would be excited by the in-plane field. So this actually is the mode that softens at the transition. And close to transition, it gains some optical strength. On the other hand, if you go to the spiral state, this mode disappears because all oscillating modes should be orthogonal to the static one. And the lowest one is now this out-of-plane mode. And this out-of-plane mode is actually what is called the electromagnet. So it is shown here. So here I kind of represent a BC spiral. So the wave vector is out of plane along the B direction, and the induced polarization is along C. If I now apply field along A, it will cant a little bit the spins, so we'll actually rotate a little bit the spiral plane so that the induced polarization would be along the field. Now field oscillates, electric field oscillates in this direction. Polarization will also oscillate, so that's the electromagnet. And now if you go through the flop transition when the spiral plane changes from BC to AC, this mode becomes very soft. And actually that is what, in my opinion, is responsible for the giant magnetocapacitance effect. Okay, so the last part is the polarization of induced by domain walls. It's actually very easy to understand without any math that you know any domain wall would induce polarization because domain wall is kind of half of the period of the spiral. Yeah. So, and again, it depends on the type of the domain wall. If in Bloch wall will induce no polarization because in this case the spin rotation axis is parallel to the wave vector, whereas the near wall will induce polarization. So if the wall is in along X and the this is a rotation plane, then it would be polarization would be along that. Okay, so domain walls of course have larger periods or domain have larger spatial extent than the period of the spiral, but then they are much more sensitive to magnetic field. So magnetic field of about 100 Hz can annihilate all domain walls completely. Another thing is that if you just take these walls are formed in thin films of ordinary ferromagnets. You don't need a particular spiral magnets. And these ferromagnets can have very high transition temperature, which is probably important for applications. So maybe in view of time, let me just skip all the theory. If you do, if you look how this, what would be the analog of this sinusoidal spiral transition in the domain wall, in the mean field, you get the following picture. So first, the out-of-plane component appears, and this is, say, our cosinusoidal component, as you know, in the spiral magnet. Then, in the second stage, this cosinusoidal component is transformed into this domain array with polarization along that or anti-parallel to that. Then, at some point, there appears also the in-plane component, which means that spins in the domain starts rotating. Now, it turns out that in the lowest energy state, the in-plane component is the same in all domain walls, whereas if it's, you know, when it changes, so this state has higher energy. And that corresponds to opposite rotation of spins in nearest domain walls. So which is easy to understand because domain wall, Niel domain wall, apart from, you know, producing polarization, it also carries in-plane magnetization. And this in-plane magnetization due to magneto-dipolar interaction want to be parallel. However, this interaction is rather weak, and by applying electric field, you can reorient spins in the domain walls much like you can do it, you know, like what Yosh Takura told about these spiral magnets, in such a way that all polarization in all domain walls would be the same. So we did some Monte Carlo simulation because actually the magnetic fluctuation here play an important role. So what happens that even if your conditions are such that out-of-plane component is more favorable, first, at higher temperatures, the spins are ordered in, along the x direction. And in this particular case, they also form the domain in the x direction. But now, when you lower the temperature, you see that the stripes in the z direction are formed, so there is this so-called reorientation transition. And the x component in all planes, on all domain walls has the same sign, so either all blue or all red. But if you switch electric field, you see that so that's the situation at zero field or a very weak field when magnetization on all domain walls is the same, but then polarization of neighboring wall has different sign. But if you switch electric field along that, then the in-plane magnetization changes sign from wall to wall, but then polarization has the same sign in all walls. And that results in the huge increase of, large increase of electric polarization and appreciable peak in the electric constant. So I'll skip the very last part. Let me just come to the conclusion. So I showed that dielectric response of multiferroics is governed by magnetic fluctuation, that ferromagnetic thin films might be, a way to get high temperature multiferroics. And then I didn't tell about the last part. Thank you for your attention.
I just want to repeat Barnhide questions. Did you calculate the magnitude of reduction of the spin in your spin wave theory?
Not yet.
So another question is, how about the omega dependence of the dielectric constant according to your spin wave theory in the collinear and the spiral states? You mentioned about the two magnon continuum.
Yeah, so I'm calculating two magnon continuum. So far, I calculated only one magnon, and it's somewhat different from the perfectly circular spiral because, say, actually what the theory gives you that in the collinear phase there is some in-plane component of dielectric constant. But then it more or less disappears in the circular phase, and then it appears, reappears in the out-of-plane direction. But otherwise, it's more or less like what you would see for a circular spiral.
Yeah, Manfred?
A comment on the domain wall-induced magnetoelectric effects, I think, reading the last line there, that the large magnetocapacitance in hexagonal manganites is just due to this domain wall-induced effect, because you have a massive formation of domain walls in hexagonal manganites at certain phase transitions. So it need not only be the ferromagnetic phase.
That might contribute, but since I didn't tell about, I don't know whether. So there the point is that that this material actually contains two phases, one of which at low temperature, in low field has weak ferromagnetic moment, and when you switch on magnetic field, then this phase actually becomes dominating. But it is present actually this A2 phase, so-called A2 phase, is present in some amount for any non-zero magnetic field. And it is, according to our understanding, it is this phase that determines the magnetocapacitance even when the more stable phase is B2 phase. So that was the idea.
And here I would say when you go through the phase transition, you have a massive formation of domain walls. So the domain wall-induced magnetoelectric effect probably comes on top of this.
Could be, yeah. But the plot for the magnetocapacitance that we had, matches the what experimentally is observed so nicely. That so there is probably an effect of domain walls, but we didn't consider.
Yeah, I'd also like to get back to Bernard's question. It really bothers me, and many of us, I think, that you would have an ionic type picture with a manganese with a spin of three halves or a spin of two, mm-hmm. but certainly you won't change in any of the energy scales you're working with. So it has to be two, and you're creating a spin density wave mm-hmm. where some of the manganese have at least a projection of a spin, which is zero along some yeah. along some axis.
Yeah.
That would mean that the quantum fluctuations, the only thing that can do it is quantum fluctuations,
yeah, yeah.
and that they would have to be driving the spin density wave phase in the first place. And then I don't understand how mean field theories like you're doing could have any significance.
I thought quantum fluctuations are certainly the only ones that remain in zero temperature. Yeah? And even though you know your spins are maximal, you still have phase fluctuations. Yeah, and that would reduce, say, the average spin on any particular. Yeah. No, fluctuations are not driven by the transition. So the transition is not driven by, I think, fluctuations. They are probably very big at the fluctuation. The transition, of course, is just driven by the, you know, it's just conventional.
That is zero or very, very small in some regions in space.
At low temperatures.
How can I get it?
At low temperatures, to my opinion, you cannot get it, yeah, unless, you know, you take into account quantum fluctuation. But we are talking now about, you know, 40 Kelvin, yeah? So at 40 Kelvin, you can get it.
How? With a spin that is 2. We know the spin is 2.
It
must be fluctuating then very dramatically. So it must be.
The average value of spin is not 2 at 40 Kelvin. It's still small.
Well, this is what bothers me. We know that the average value of the spin is 2. The spin, yeah. Not the projection. S squared, quantum number.
There's no contradiction. S is 2, but on that average measure.
Well, wait a minute. He said something different.
No, I think that, if I understand correctly, that close to the, you know, transition into the collinear phase, the average, you know, value of spin, even if you, you know, you add all the components, is still less than 2 because it's still at high temperature. So there are thermal fluctuations that, quantum fluctuation. I think in that area, thermal fluctuation probably play an important role.
It must be my stupidity that I'm not really not understanding something, because mm-hmm. a spin density wave generally is considered as an amplitude wave. That the amplitude, you're doing it as a projection, but then it still has to be so that the spin still is 2, shall we say, but it doesn't have any static component along any particular direction.
No, I mean, so that, you know, there are two possibilities here, in fact. I'm actually working with Landau theory, yeah, where your order parameter, you know, appears gradually, yeah, and when it is small, yeah, I have no problem with collinear state, yeah. Now, in principle, it can be that already at rather high temperatures you have, you know, essentially you already have the spiral state, but, you know, its phase somehow fluctuates randomly, so all what remains is only one component, yeah? But that is very difficult to, you know, treat theoretically. And that has not been done yet. But I'm not sure that close to transition that actually that what you have to do.
Actually, I completely agree with your picture that only quantum fluctuation can modulate the amplitude. So that's why I try to formulate in terms of the bosons, right? Then that means that the perturbative treatment is totally wrong. And then we need to start from the strong fluctuating limit. Actually, the electricity mm-hmm. is 0.7
Again,
in the lowest
temperature,
right?
Temperature, yeah.
So then that means this reduction due to the quantum fluctuation is very large, even at the zero temperature limit. And also another argument is that if you look at the fluctuation, the energy of the fluctuation, this phason is almost zero energy. Yep. But this electromagnon is 2.5 milli-electron volt, mm-hmm. very high energy, right? So that's why it is very difficult to imagine that starting from this ground state, this rotating around the B-axis is first excited to produce a collinear state. So that's why I think, right? So the phason is a more low energy, right? Then it is more easy to imagine that this phason is excited first to give you some
liquid very well might be, there, right? But I don't see anything wrong, you know. When you just have a transition into magnetic state, first your order parameter is still small, yeah? Whether it's collinear or non-collinear, yeah?
No, I'm starting from the lower temperature.
No, low temperature is, again, a different story, yeah?
But what is excited to destroy this spiral into the collinear state? Then the first things to do is to excite the low energy excitation, right?
No, that I completely agree. So at zero temperatures, you should take into account, at low temperatures, you should take into account this phason and all other degrees of freedom. But you should do it non-perturbatively, or at least, you know, in a different way.
Are there any more questions? Well, if not, then let's thank the speaker again, and maybe we can continue later.